Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. How did a routine trip by an 800-foot commercial freighter from Jacksonville, Florida to Puerto Rico last fall become the worst commercial maritime disaster in decades? The ship, the El Faro, ran into Tropical Storm Joaquin as it strengthened into a Category 3 hurricane as the boat was caught between hazardous rock and the open sea. Hearings are set to begin today in Jacksonville on the sinking of the ship and could give family members of those lost a final chance to learn something about their loved ones who have simply disappeared. Ryan Bank is a reporter for WJCT in Jacksonville. He's been following the story. He joins me now. Ryan, how important are these hearings?
Well, they are absolutely integral to figuring out exactly what happened to the 33 crew members of the El Faro. And they're integral to the family because as of right now, we don't really know exactly what led up to the ship sinking around the Bahamas October 1st. So it'll be very important to see what they may find out during the course of the next 10 days regarding the ship's history, its safety inspections, employment history of the crew, and years of voyage logs. We're talking about a pretty old ship. It's about 40 years old.
And we're also talking about trying to get into the mind of the captain of the ship. And here's Claudette Riley, who's the sister of a crew person, Mariette Wright, who was lost on board the El Faro. And here she is speaking about what remains in her mind, the questions.
Of course, everybody still, all of us question why the boat went out when it did. They can only go by what the captain's decision was. I don't know if it was just his decisions or the company and the captain.
Well, this really gets at the crux of the matter here, which is, did the captain, Michael Davidson, decide alone, unilaterally, to take the path through Hurricane Joaquin so that they wouldn't lose time on their trip to Puerto Rico? Some have theorized that it is possible that a representative of TOT Maritime Services, or TOT Puerto Rico, who is the operator of the ship, might have coerced the captain into taking that path instead of waiting or taking a long way around the storm, which could have meant lost money and lost time. But at this point, we don't know. I think it's also worthy to say that Claudette Riley was saying that she wasn't necessarily sure that there was anything else to discover more than what TOT Maritime Services was saying. She thought they were being very transparent, but that was still a question that was weighing very heavily on her mind and on her heart.
And will certainly be part of the hearings, as will just grieving be a part of the hearings, whether it's in testimony or not. Here's Derek Davis, who's the son of the crew watchman on the El Faro, Larry Davis.
In these tragic cases, sometimes, you know, people have a really hard time adjusting. But I know that he would want us to be strong, and I know that he knows that we are strong enough to handle this. And so I want to make him proud, and I want to continue to be as you know, much of a man and as independent as I can be.
And this, of course, is the maritime culture, the commercial maritime culture of bravery in the face of the elements that you find in cities all over coastlines, all over the world, Ryan. And that's very much evident here as well.
Right. I mean, the strength of the families. We spoke to Derek Davis at the very first vigil for the crew members. He's actually has been living in Taiwan for 7 years. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of just how far some of these family members had to travel to get back after hearing the news that the El Faro was missing at that point in time. They hadn't even discovered it yet. And I think he kind of epitomizes this maritime culture. They're very, very, very guarded of their own. They're very brave. And it is something that's very important to them.
Ryan Bank is a reporter for WJCT in Jacksonville, Florida. Ryan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
How do maritime captains make judgments and evaluate information in potentially dangerous situations? Was the ship, the El Faro, fit to sail in the path of a hurricane? And how much did the crew know about the storm surrounding them? John Conrad is a veteran captain and CEO of G-Captain, a news website dedicated to maritime professionals, and author of the book Fire on the Horizon, The Untold Story of the Gulf Oil Disaster.
Time is really your friend with these hurricane situations, time and distance. When NOAA gives you a weather prediction for a hurricane, they're giving you multiple routes. There could be up to 10 different routes that this hurricane may go. Now, why they decided to get this close is a difficult question, but at some point, they ran out of options because there were islands to one side of them and the hurricane to the other side. So it's a classic case of being between a rock and a hard place.
How likely is it that financial pressure would weigh into the decision of launching anyway?
This is a shrinking industry. There are very few American flag jobs left. Most of them have been pushed overseas. And we are in the business of delivering the cargo on time. There are financial pressures throughout the company from the lowest levels to the top. And mariners are really a profession of people who take pride in getting the job done.
And do those pressures lead to recklessness, or do those pressures lead to decisions made without the proper information?
I don't think it's either per se. What it really is there are a lot of small decisions that have to be made. Do we turn here? Do we slow down? Long before you actually get to the hurricane, and long before it really becomes apparent you're in immediate danger.
If you're a captain, do you have other sources of weather information besides NOAA?
In a smaller company like the owner of the El Faro, they subscribe to a third-party weather service that provides additional tracking. And the maritime industry copied the aviation and started requiring ships just a few years ago to have black boxes. We call them VDRs, voyage data recorders, and they record the audio of the bridge, everything that's happening, as well as the charting and the equipment. They're supposed to be watertight, and they're supposed to ping just like the aviation black box. But we haven't found that with the El Faro, and we have a very bad track record of recovering these VDRs in the last few years. We have the fire on the horizon, the Deepwater Horizon BP oil rig, one of the biggest environmental disasters in history, and we still haven't found the VDR there. And they have a limited lifespan. They can't last underwater indefinitely.
And in this particular case, is there a reason why the VDR wouldn't have either been triggered or been findable?
The NTSB was not right on the scene. They could have hired a commercial tug. Instead, they negotiated with the Navy, and it took a very long time for the salvage vessel to get there.
What's the lesson then from this hearing, and what conceivably should Americans take away from the hazards at sea and the potential for cargo and people on the seas getting caught in a situation like the El Faro did?
Well, 90% of everything you purchase comes from the sea, and the sea is this vast place. And it's really up to the captains and the construction of the ship to keep them safe. The other takeaway here is we have to put more emphasis on these black boxes, the VDRs. We have to get out there right after the sinking and recover this, because we don't have the information, and this is very important for the trials.
John Conrad is a veteran captain, author of the book Fire on the Horizon, The Untold Story of the Gulf Oil Disaster. He's CEO of G-Captain, which is a news website dedicated to maritime professionals. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.